I'm Ross Reynolds. It's Week in Review. I'm here for Bill Radke today. Monica Nicholsberg, City Civic Innovation Editor for GeekWire, is with us too, as is David Croman, City Reporter for Crosscut, and Erica C. Barnett. Her blog is C is for Crank. Also with us, social media goddess Bree Ripley. You can tweet at us at KUOW. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg testified before the House and Senate this week about the massive data breach that exposed the private information of Facebook users. A company called Cambridge Analytica used it to create 30 million psychographic profiles of voters, and those profiles in turn were sold to politicians seeking to influence voters. Senator Dick Durbin questioned Mark Zuckerberg about that.
Mr. Zuckerberg. Would you be comfortable sharing with us the name of the hotel you stayed in last night?
No.
If you've messaged anybody this week, would you share with us the names of the people you've messaged?
Senator, no, I would probably not choose to do that publicly here.
I think that may be what this is all about.
Monica Nicholsberg, is that what this is really all about, Facebook sharing private messages, information like what hotel you're staying at?
I think it's what it's all about in a broader sense, which I know sounds exactly like what Mark Zuckerberg repeated over and over again during those 9 hours. But I think it is about the nature of privacy and our information and what you have a right to keep to yourself and what you don't have a right to keep to yourself, what can be shared by companies who have your information. I actually really liked that line of questioning amid a lot of questions that felt kind of like Congress tech support that didn't really seem like they struck at the heart of the issue. It was a kind of offbeat, broad question, but it did really drill into something that I think he got a little uncomfortable. Mark Zuckerberg got a little uncomfortable. And we all took a moment to think about, just because it's digital, does that mean that we no longer have a right to that privacy?
Right. Erica, what's the harm here? Why should we be concerned about Facebook and privacy and how that information is being used?
Well, the reason I'm concerned is not even so much that corporations know what to target me with as far as advertising, but the fact that, you know, we don't know how this information is being used. And the more that companies like Facebook, and it's not just Facebook, it's Twitter, it's Snapchat, it's, you know, Instagram, which is owned by Facebook, the more that they can track us, the more they can be sharing our private information with who knows who. I mean, it could go to potential employers. It could go to law enforcement. It could go to immigration enforcement. So my concern is that, you know, Facebook in particular can find out a lot of information about me that I'm not necessarily even directly sharing with them, such as, you know, my sexual orientation, my criminal history, whether I have a history of addiction, whether I have a history of leaving jobs after 6 weeks. So my concern is that this information could actually be used, you know, in the real world, potentially against people in ways that they don't even anticipate when they're signing away their rights in that privacy agreement.
Erica said could be used. David Croman, is there a lot of evidence that it has been used to harm people, the sharing of this private information?
I mean, I guess it depends on your definition of harm. I mean,
yes.
If there are a lot of Facebook users who did not support Donald Trump for presidency, and then here their data is being used to assist in that, allegedly. So you could paint that as harm. There was one story that suggested that Immigration and Customs Enforcement was sort of using some Facebook data to go after a certain case. So that could be called as harm. I think what's hard about it is when, at least when I first signed up for Facebook, I think there was this sort of twinge about it, saying, you know, I'm agreeing to give a lot of my personal information to a multi-billion-dollar corporation, but you sort of convince yourself that maybe it won't be used in ways that you're uncomfortable with. And the last few weeks have sort of, I think, confirmed that small fear that maybe many of us have. Something that I think, had I thought about it, I probably knew was happening all along. But now that it's out there, it's forcing people to kind of question it.
Well, there's an option now. I think it's new that you can actually download all the data that Facebook has about you.
Mm-hmm.
You just go to that arrow on the top right of the Facebook page, click on settings, and you can see an option to download it. So I did that, and I went through it. I saw a message someone had shared their phone number with me, and I thought, that's a little weird. She obviously didn't want to share that phone number with everybody. Now I assume anybody could get it if they had that information. But you mentioned, David, that you had also downloaded your information. Did you find anything alarming in that?
Well, I think what was alarming about it was seeing it's sort of visual proof of how interconnected all of your devices and all of your sort of apps are. So when you sign up for Facebook Messenger, for example, you or I apparently had agreed to provide all of the contacts in my phone. So it's all these people that I'm not necessarily Facebook friends with their phone numbers listed there. And I've actually had weird experiences before where I will be communicating with a source or somebody who maybe doesn't want to be named in a story. And then when I go to my Facebook page, Facebook is recommending that I be Facebook friends with that Ooh. With that person. And so, you know, back to Erica's point, you know, I'm not an FBI reporter or some sort of, you know, the government probably doesn't care who my sources are, but there
you never
is,
know, David. Right?
There is a world in which if, you know, say the FBI wanted to know who somebody was communicating with anonymously, Facebook has figured it out clearly. So what is stopping them from providing that information?
Monica, have you downloaded your information and found anything alarming that you found out Facebook had that maybe you didn't realize they had?
I haven't, because I feel like there probably will be some stuff in there that's alarming or objectionable to me. And I feel like at this point, I don't really have the option to delete my Facebook. So it's been on my list. I'm going to download it, but I've always found an excuse not to over the past few days.
And I haven't downloaded my information. I think that, you know, first of all, I'm lazy. There's probably stuff I don't want to see or be reminded of, you know? I mean, because I've been on Facebook since, I don't know, 2007 or something, whenever they started allowing non-college students to be on it. But, you know, and I also think that creates a false sense of power that we can actually control in the way any of this information is used. And I think that, you know, that is what Mark Zuckerberg, I think, wants people to feel, that, well, you can go in and you can delete your apps or you can delete Messenger from your phone. But I don't believe that actually does anything really significant. And to David's point, I had the exact same experience recently where I was doing a story that had multiple, many, many sources who were talking completely, you know, off the record or on background, and they were suggested to me as friends. And I don't know why. I could probably try to trace back why that might be, but I have no idea. And that's the problem. We don't know how these companies are using our data, and reading the privacy agreement won't give us that information, you know, to any satisfaction. So it sort of feels like any change has to come from without rather than from on the user end.
Yeah, I think what Erica is mentioning is something that a lot of people feel, which is this powerlessness. And that's why I think some of the proposals to move away from putting it in the consumer's hand are interesting, because Mark Zuckerberg, he does say that over and over. You can control your data. You can download your profile.
He said that many times.
And obviously, these hearings were about the fact that nobody feels like that's true. Nobody feels like they have control of their data and it's in their hands.
Well, there's feelings and facts. Is it true or isn't it?
It's both. I mean, you can manage some things. I think there's a lot more that Facebook knows about you and does with your data than they're saying. And I think there's a lot that you can't manage. So shifting to maybe a regulatory structure where it's not on the consumer, it's not the consumer's burden to manage their data safely, might be the best option.
Well, and Mark Zuckerberg, this is not the first time he's apologized. He's apologized over and over again. It becomes a regular ritual every couple of years. Of course, this time he was doing it to Congress, and this raises the question, should Congress get involved? Should there be more regulation? That was the subject of Republican Lindsey Graham's question for Mark Zuckerberg in the hearings this week.
One way to regulate a company is through competition, through government regulation. Here's the question that all of us got to answer. What do we tell our constituents, given what's happened here, why we should let you self-regulate? What would you tell people in South Carolina that, given all the things we've just discovered here, it's a good idea for us to rely upon you to regulate your own business practices?
Well, Senator, my position is not that there should be no regulation. Okay. I think the internet is increasingly
important. You embrace regulation?
I think the real question, as the internet becomes more important in people's lives, is what is the right regulation, not whether there should be or not.
But you as a company welcome regulation?
I think if it's the right regulation, then yes.
You think the Europeans have it right?
I think that they get things right.
Have you ever submitted? That's true. So would you work with us in terms of what regulations you think are necessary in your industry?
Absolutely.
That part of the question about European regulation I thought was pretty interesting, because there's much tighter regulation in Europe, is there not, Monica? Isn't there a right to be forgotten?
Yes, and it's new. It's called GDPR, General Data Protection Regulation, I think. And the EU just passed it, and it's pretty sweeping. It includes the right to be forgotten, meaning you have the right to tell a company, delete everything you know about me. And there's a consent element of it that's also really important, which means you have to actively consent to any of your data being shared by a company.
So when Mark Zuckerberg says he'd be open to regulation if it was the right regulation, you're skeptical about this ever happening.
I am skeptical because there was a really strong pattern throughout both of the hearings where anytime regulation came up, he philosophically was into it. He was very supportive of like the idea of more privacy protection. But on almost every single occasion that they asked about specific legislation, he really waffled and refused to endorse it, except maybe the Honest Ads Act.
Well, it's so interesting because regulating Facebook begs the question of what is Facebook, which came up a lot. Is this a social media company? They do banking. They do all kinds of things. Is there any way that the federal government could get a handle on this to do meaningful regulation? They did it with the banking industry, and that's a pretty complicated industry. What do you think, Erica?
Well, one thing that struck me during the questioning, and I didn't listen to as much of it as Monica did, but one thing that struck me was that the Congress, particularly the senior people who are allowed to speak first and ask all the first questions, were sort of really unclear about what social media is, what Facebook is, what the internet is. And I think Zuckerberg really took advantage of that when he was talking about, Facebook does have competition. I mean, there are text messages and Twitter, and like those are completely different things. I mean, Twitter has some of the same aspects, but he was really obfuscating. And I think that is going to be one of the challenges if Congress is going to regulate this is understanding what social media is, how it works, and what the implications of Facebook having all this data are, because I don't think that they have a very firm grasp on it.
It's a real issue. It's a shape-shifting entity. Any thoughts, David, on how you could actually begin to do some kind of regulation to ensure privacy on this in this Bay Area?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I liked we'd read about it in advance of coming out of the show was this sort of fiduciary responsibility for holding onto the data. The article that I saw compared it to sort of doctors and the HIPAA Act, sort of lawyers being required to act on the best interest of their clients because there's such a disconnect between, there's such a knowledge gap between a patient and a doctor or a client and a lawyer. There's an acknowledgement that those people could, if they wanted to, really take advantage of their clients. And so I think I liked the comparison here that it's disingenuous to put this on the people signing up for Facebook to a certain extent because there's such a knowledge gap between what the people signing up for Facebook are doing. And so I like the idea that there would be some sort of fiduciary responsibility with people's data.
Well, what about a simple thing where you have to opt in rather than opt out? Right now, as I understand it, you're kind of automatically in here. And as Mark Zuckerberg says, you can go in and change these things. But if you had to go into those things, it would automatically guarantee your privacy. Is that even a feasible thing to do, Monica?
It might be feasible, but I think that it's one of those things that sounds a lot better in theory than in practice because we have a lot of those controls now. But anytime a user has to do a thing, when you have to opt in and you have to consent, it shifts that burden onto the consumer. And if the agreement is more than two sentences, the vast majority of us are just going to say, it's probably fine, or I don't care that much. Like, I want to use this thing. I'm in a hurry, and not read it and not really understand what we're consenting to. So I really like this idea of having Facebook register or have a fiduciary responsibility to its users. And I also like it because then it allows states to enact their own regulations rather than trying to wait for the federal government, which is not always very effective.
Wow. Is that practical since Facebook goes everywhere for states to do their own regulations?
Well, I think that the net neutrality battle that's playing out in various states right now will be a really good test case because it's really about that same thing, the internet as this global utility that we all use, and yet there are local governments who are trying to pass their own piecemeal regulations to ensure that at least their constituents get to have net neutrality, and now these internet providers have to figure out how to comply with that in various markets.
That's Monica Nicholsberg. She's our guest here on Week in Review, along with David Croman, city reporter for Crosscut, and Erica C. Barnett. Coming up, the gender gap at City Hall, it's worse than you thought. This is Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds. Tweet at us if you've got some thoughts on our topics today. It's at KUOW. Bree Ripley will take a look, and we might hear from you that way. Studies have shown that women who work for the city of Seattle get paid less than men in equivalent positions. But David Croman, you're out with the story headlined, Seattle's gender pay gap is worse than we thought. What did you learn?
Well, I learned that, and Erica has written about this too, but in 2015, the city came out with this study that they had commissioned that basically said Seattle women who work for the city of Seattle make 90 cents to the man's dollar, which, you know, obviously that's an issue, but they sort of in some ways celebrated it at the time as being better than the national average, which is 77 cents or so.
But they forgot something.
What they didn't include was overtime, which, especially if you look at the transportation and utilities departments, which make up about $3 billion of the city's $5.6 billion budget, so fairly good chunk, 92% of all overtime in 2017 went to men. And so when you look at the sort of large amount of money that they spend on overtime, which is about $43 million in 2017, that alone, that disproportionality alone was enough to, in those three departments, drag the pay equity ratio down from about 90 cents to the dollar to like 78 cents to the dollar, back to kind of what national averages are.
Do we know why the women got so much less overtime, this lucrative overtime that the men got?
Yeah, I mean, it's that the jobs that are eligible for the most overtime or tend to get the most overtime are just totally dominated by men. So these are the fields where people are going out and responding to power outages or hooking up new construction onto the grid, line workers, cable splicers, things like that. They're, you know, 93% men or something like that. And so, you know, it's not necessarily, although some people might argue this, but it's not necessarily that there's a boss sort of making the conscious decision to give this man more money than this woman, but it is that somewhere upstream, these jobs were determined to be men's jobs, and those jobs also happen to be the jobs that allow
get the overtime.
Yeah,
and that's kind of your take on this, Erica. You've talked about gender tracking. Just explain what that is and why that accentuates this disparity.
Yeah, the common or the I guess official term for it is occupational segregation. And what it means is that, you know, the city declared victory in a way in 2015 when they said, oh, there's only this 10 cent pay gap compared to a 73 cent on the dollar pay gap citywide. The problem with that is that you have occupational tracking so that women are primarily in administrative jobs, in lower paying positions throughout the city. So, and in fact, in that 2015 study, they actually took out City Light, Fire, and Police and said, if we just remove these, then there really is no pay gap at all at the city. What that does is it prevents the city from addressing the underlying issue of hiring women into these jobs and not recruiting women actively into the higher paying positions at City Light, at Fire, at Police. I think at the time when I looked at the SWAT team, for example, it was 100% men. There might have been one woman, but I think it was 100%. So the issue is that we have this segregation of work. And, you know, people can point to all different kinds of reasons for that. You know, one argument is that quote unquote female jobs are more flexible. But studies have actually shown that they're not. I mean, if you look at retail jobs, if you look at the jobs that tend to skew more female administrative jobs in society as a whole, they're not more flexible. They just pay less. Mm-hmm. And so that is the problem that I think, you know, the city has failed to address. And it speaks both to, you know, the fact that women are not in these jobs that pay overtime, but also they're just not in those departments and divisions, period.
So that begs the question of why aren't they? Are they not being recruited into those jobs where they could get more overtime, get paid more?
Well, I think that is a big part of it. I think that we have active recruiting, or we say we have active recruiting for, you know, minority and women, you know, minorities and women, essentially, is all just kind of lumped into one category. And the city always says it's doing something about, you know, the racial disparity in hiring at the city and the gender disparity in hiring. But if you look at the stats, it doesn't back that up. So I do think the city has to take active measures instead of just saying, as I said in 2015, well, the job pool just skews more male in those departments. Well, that's the same excuse we hear from tech companies all the time. Oh, we just couldn't find any qualified women candidates. In 2018, you know, in 2015, that wasn't a good enough excuse, and it's certainly not a good excuse now either.
Well, you're for one employee at the City of Seattle. Maybe you've got something to say about this. Tweet at us, at KUOW. We'd like to get your thoughts on it. And Monica, you have talked about this is not foreign to when you talk about the tech industry, the same kind of gender tracking, getting people into jobs that are naturally going to pay more and that favors men.
Yeah, and that when I read your story in this discussion, it just keeps me wondering how things might be different if there were women in leadership positions, because in the technology industry, which also struggles with these same issues, the companies that do hire or elevate women and people of color to leadership positions are much more successful at then creating a more diverse workforce. And those teams tend to create better products because they represent a wider range of people's needs and problems and views. So I really feel like the problem needs to be addressed at the top, and maybe these organizations or agencies aren't doing enough to recruit women and people of color at a high level who can then bring on more people on those teams.
That's really interesting, because we've had a current police chief and the former police chief were both women. And I wonder if there's anything that's happened because of that, if what you say is true. David?
Yeah, I was just going to say that I think we've probably all experienced that getting a job is so much easier when you know somebody and you have a connection to that job. And once upon a time when line workers became sort of a, quote, man's job, then people pass it on to friends and even family. And it's just sort of now that it's been determined to be sort of gendered in this way, breaking out of it is hard because you have to sort of break up that sort of networking chain.
Yeah, and I think a similar thing happened. I mean, this is going way back in history, but with computer programmers, that used to be primarily a women's job, and it paid less, and it started paying more when it became perceived as a man's job.
I got to ask, there are unions involved with a lot of these city employees. Where are the unions on this gender pay equity issue on getting women into some of these areas where they could be getting paid more? Do any of you know?
That's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I think unions are often in the business of protecting their current employees. Mm-hmm. So I think that could, I'm not saying it necessarily that I know that it is, but that could be a factor.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a, when you sort of ask what the city's doing about it, they point to apprenticeship programs and sort of pre-apprenticeship programs and trainings and things like that. And I think the unions are pretty heavily involved in those sort of efforts, but I haven't seen... I mean, clearly there's still this issue. So I haven't seen the data to see whether or not these are effective or not. I've heard sort of anecdotally that no, they're not that effective, mm-hmm. but that seems to be the main focus.
Well, we just talked about women at the top maybe being able to change things. And we'll talk more about Mayor Durkan in a few moments, but any signs from the mayor's office that anything's changing?
Well, I have heard anecdotally that that one thing that has changed in the departments and in the mayor's office itself is that it has become, and this is purely anecdotal, but that it has become a more welcoming environment for women than was the case under former Mayor Ed Murray and under former Mayor Mike McGinn. I've just heard anecdotally that discussions are more collaborative. There's less shouting. There's less shutting people down and cutting people off. I don't know how much those sort of one-on-one style interactions within departments filter down to things like hiring. But I can see how they would certainly lead to better retention of people, of women in particular, who feel like their voices are being heard, and people of color as well.
Wow.
I've heard. Again, it is, like Erica said, it's anecdotal, but I've heard exactly the same thing, which is, one person talked about how meetings at the city used to be these big conference tables where with a bunch of men sitting around it and then the women sitting in chairs kind of along the wall on the outside, and that since Mayor Durkan has come in, there have been more women sitting at those tables. Mayor Durkan had an event on Women's Day sort of celebrating the women elected officials, and I spoke to a few different women who work for the city, and that, was pretty meaningful to them. I agree with Erica. I think people are still sort of skeptical until they see sort of concrete action to fix some of these things. But I would say that the mood right now among the women I have spoke to is sort of cautious optimism.
Hmm. Well, we'd like to hear your anecdotes. You can tweet at us at KUOW if you've experienced some differences working for the city under our new female mayor when it comes to issues like pay equity. It's Week in Review. I'm Ross Reynolds here for Bill Radke. Our guests, David Croman, city reporter for Crosscut, Monica Nicholsburg, civic innovation editor for GeekWire, and Erica C. Barnett. Her blog is C for Crank. Stay with us. You're listening to Week in Review, where we thrash over the week's events with a panel of journalists. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Erica C. Barnett is with us. Her blog is The C is for Crank. Monica Nicholsburg, civic innovation editor for GeekWire. And David Croman, city editor for Crosscut. Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan is finishing up her fifth month in office. Jenny Durkan, here's what she's had to say at her first State of the City address.
The impatient mayor. Seriously, it's what they call me.
Is Mayor Durkan impatient? And if so, is that something to be bragging about? Erica?
Well, it's interesting. She calls herself that. But what I have heard, is that there's been kind of a delay in staffing up her office, some departments. And I think what she is best known for right now is sort of shutting things down. And that is, you know, both a factor related to her predecessor. She put a halt on the streetcar downtown when cost overruns came in from the previous SDOT director, from under the previous SDOT director. And she's, you know, sort of saying, let's slow down, let's slow down, let's slow down. She asked for budget cuts from the departments to in anticipation of a potential economic slowdown. So if I was picking an adjective to describe her, you know, impatient would not be in the top five.
Well, in fact, you've said maybe a hallmark is that she's somewhat fiscally restrained.
Yes. I mean, I do think that she has been made fiscal responsibility slash restraint slash stinginess, you know, depending on your political perspective, part of her agenda. And I think that that's going to really affect how people perceive her. I think, you know, the Chamber of Commerce types are going to say, well, this is good because we're, you know, there's going to be another economic downturn. We need to anticipate budget cuts, things like that. And not just the Chamber of Commerce types, but, you know, I myself have opined that this is something that mayors do and that it's good to realize that economies have cycles. And I think sometimes mayors don't do that. And then from the left, you know, I think she's getting a lot of flack already for suggesting budget cuts, for slowing down transportation projects, for stopping the 4th Avenue bike lane. That's been really unpopular with bike advocates. So, you know, it just kind of depends on which side you come from. But she's definitely not a full speed ahead, you know, tax and spend kind of mayor.
Although she has jumped up to say congestion pricing is something we might consider to try to eliminate some of the clogged up downtown by charging people when they're on city streets in a particular area. They do that in London and some other places. Monica, what do you think about that?
I think it's a really interesting proposal and at least in the U.S., novel approach to reducing single occupant vehicles downtown. I'm curious how that might interact with the Move Seattle reset that I know Erica wrote about this week.
And Move Seattle, explain what that is.
Yeah, Move Seattle was the $930 million transportation levy that was passed in 2015. And it's in the process behind the scenes of being, quote unquote, reset, which means that they're going to probably scale back on some of the projects. On congestion pricing, I'm very skeptical that that's ever going to happen. I think that's a trial balloon that she's floating, and there has been so much negative response to it. I personally think it makes a lot of sense because people who are, you know, we only have 30% of people who work downtown that drive there in, you know, single occupancy cars. So we're talking about a lot of spending on a small portion of the population.
And
so
actually, the city's had some success in decreasing the number of people driving downtown alone and parking. Mm-hmm. The 30% figure suggests that. But congestion pricing, is that very far out there? What do you think, David?
I think it's kind of far out there. Again, not to speak to whether or not it's actually, you know, a good or bad idea, but you know, the implication when they unveiled it was that they would probably have to go to voters to get approval for this, just to get the taxing authority to do it. And the arguments that I've seen in favor of it is that, you know, basically at first everybody is going to hate it. And then once people get used to it and sort of see that there's increased revenue and sort of increased focus on transit, people will come around to it, which makes a certain amount of sense. But if you have to get voter approval, then you might not ever get past that first right. step of people are going to hate it. You know, Washington has shown that they vote down income taxes and things like that. I'm just not convinced that people would necessarily vote.
Although Seattle voters seem to vote for tax increases all the time. They seem to do that often.
Right, because you can, you know, it's a number on your property tax bill. It's not an inconvenience to getting to work, which people already feel fairly heavily.
Well, I think, you know, we can't even get buses, you know, on 3rd Avenue all day. We can't even get cars off of 3rd Avenue so that 3rd Avenue can be a transit right. hub. We can't even get a bike lane on 4th Avenue, which is a very wide one-way street, or a protected bike lane. And so I'm very skeptical that we're going to turn into London in the next, right. you know, administration. And
probably not.
I think this is also sort of indicative of it's sort of hard to pin down exactly what kind of mayor Jenny Durkin is so far, because there's this, at least that week when she announced the congestion tolling, this sort of whiplash where within a couple of days she pauses the streetcar, but then which is, you know, people are sort of howling, some on the left were kind of howling about, was cutting down on transit, but then also unveils this congestion pricing proposal, which some of those same people are applauding. You know, what, which direction are we headed in this? I'm not sure people know exactly.
Monica, isn't congestion pricing a technical challenge? I mean, how do you figure out that people are on these streets in order to charge them for using those streets? It seems like there'd be a cost associated. You're getting revenue in and you're discouraging people from driving, but it costs a lot of money to enforce that system, doesn't it?
I'm sure it does. And it sounds like it would need to rely on a lot of data. And that's a very buzzy thing right now in like the smart cities world, is collecting transit data and using it for actual insights. I think a lot of it is more theoretical and like wants to be ahead of where it actually is in terms of being able to digest that data and use it to reduce congestion downtown. So I don't know. I mean, like, I think this is the first, this, if Seattle did it, we'd be the first city in the U.S. to do it, right? So that's a different challenge. I mean, you can look at some of the things that other cities in Europe have learned from doing it, but it would be kind of a big experiment.
And we're really bad at being the first at anything. I mean, remember safe consumption sites? We were going to be the first to do that. And now Philadelphia is moving ahead of us. And it just feels like anytime there's like a really innovative, controversial idea, we focus group it to death. And it doesn't end up happening, or we end up being the second or third or fourth city to do it.
And I don't think she could I don't think the city could get away with it unless they had some sort of paid some attention to who was being the most effective, which would probably mean sort of deductions or breaks for lower income people. And that, I think, if we're talking about data and trying to enforcing this, that sort of would further complicate that.
The Economic Opportunity Institute has a report out with a slightly new wrinkle on an old story. Washington State has long been one of the most regressive tax systems in the country. If you're poor, you pay a higher percentage of your income in taxes than if you're rich, which strikes many as fundamentally unfair. Well, now this report points out that this is largely because of Washington State. We don't have an income tax, which tends to skew the taxation system to be more progressive if you have that. But this report also points out that Seattle has the most regressive taxes in the states when you put together state and local taxes. So my question is, we're in Seattle with a left-leaning leadership, which you would think would be combating this regressive tax system. Why do we have the most regressive taxes in the state in probably the most liberal part of the state? Who's got an answer to that?
Well, I think one reason is that we keep relying on sales taxes to fund basic services. And you know, I think we have the highest sales tax in the state. I could be wrong about that, but it feels intuitively right. And also, I think I read it this morning. So we have that issue. We have low property taxes. Whatever anybody thinks, we have lower property taxes than most cities in Washington State. So as a result, we end up relying primarily on regressive taxes, like the sales tax. And I think that report found that low-income people pay something like 4% of their income on sales taxes compared to something like 1% for higher-income people. So when you look at that, that's kind of the definition of regressivity.
And I hear many Seattle politicians talk about a cure for that, but they don't talk much about what Seattle could do. They talk about what Olympia could do.
Mm-hmm. Well, one idea is the head tax, the employee hours tax on the city's biggest businesses. But outside of that, I mean, the city council is sort of hamstrung without an income tax. And I think a lot of it has to do with growth. Seattle is growing so quickly, and that causes huge problems like congestion and like homelessness and housing affordability issues. And we need, or the city council would argue that we need more revenue in order to deal with those problems. And if there's not an income tax, all we really have in our toolkit are regressive taxes.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned the head tax, which certainly would pay for homelessness and other issues that we have. It would put a lot of money into that area. But would it make the tax system any more progressive, since that money is already going to be claimed for use?
I think it would actually be a progressive tax. And I'm not saying, you know, that I support or don't support it. But it's a tax on employers that have over a certain amount in revenues. Unfortunately, that's gross revenues. It's not profits, because it's very hard to tax that way. But you're talking about a tax on employers, not employees. And so that looks to me more like a progressive tax than a tax on workers, which is, you know, what the sales tax is.
When we return, the King County Democratic chair resigns following charges of workplace misconduct and sexual harassment. It's Week in Review. With me, Monica Nicholsberg, civic innovation editor for GeekWire, David Croman, city reporter for Crosscut, and Erica C. Barnett, The C is for Crank is the name of her blog. I'm Ross Reynolds. Stick around. Bill Radke's away today. He'll be back on Monday. Our guests, David Croman, city reporter for Crosscut, Monica Nicholsberg, civic innovation editor for GeekWire, and Erica C. Barnett. You can read her at The C is for Crank. After a 13-hour internal trial following charges of financial misconduct and creating a hostile work environment, King County Democratic Chair Bailey Stober announced his resignation. Erica, you've been covering this extensively. I got to ask, was this internal trial fair?
Well, I wasn't at the internal trial because it was an internal trial. I would say that the perception from people who supported the woman at the center of all of these allegations and who opposed Bailey and, you know, and also had issues with his financial behavior would say that it should never have come to that trial because there had been three investigations prior to this that found that he had indeed committed financial misconduct and sexually harassed his one employee before firing her, and a number of other things. So I think the existence of the trial did not seem particularly fair to the advocates for the victim or the victim herself, because it really did kind of keep dragging her through this process over the course of 9 weeks.
Did any of the alleged actions rise to the level of a crime? Won't we see criminal prosecution because of this?
No. There were allegations of financial misconduct that could end up leading to a fine at some point down the line. The Public Disclosure Commission and the Attorney General's Office are investigating Bailey separately for some of the actions that he took as King County Democrats chair and also in a couple of campaigns that he ran previously. So you could see a fine. And he's also under investigation at his job at the King County Assessor's Office, and he's been on paid leave for the duration of this whole process, so for a couple months.
Are there any Bailey Stober supporters who feel that he got burned on this? Is this creating a division within the King County Democratic Party?
Yeah, there's a huge division. There's some very, very ardent supporters who have compared this to a witch hunt, have said, you know, all along that these charges are fabricated, or, you know, that various people are lying about or exaggerating the financial charges, which included stuff like, you know, spending too much money on hotels and partying on the county's dime or the county Democrats' dime and things like that. But he definitely has supporters who say that that's all made up or trumped up or not that big a deal.
Is there a counter narrative? They're really after him because of this other thing?
Well, there has been a counter narrative. At one point, Bailey is African-American. At one point, or actually at several points, this has been compared to a lynching. And this has happened in public meetings. And, you know, his accuser, who actually didn't bring the charges herself, they were brought up on her behalf by someone who witnessed his behavior, is a woman of color. But nonetheless, this has been portrayed by some as a racially motivated witch hunt.
Are the King County Democrats weakened because of this internal conflict? I mean, King County is so blue. I mean, is it really going to affect the party's ability to function going forward?
Yeah. I mean, what's kind of funny about this story is that, you know, I am not a follower of the King County Democrats. It's not a group that I typically turn to in election time to see, oh, my gosh, who are they endorsing? So, you know, in King County, it is very blue, as Bailey Stober noted in his outgoing message to PCOs. He said, you know, we won 92% of our races. Well, of course you did. You know, it's King County. So I think, you know, the bigger issue is going to be stuff like raising money for specific candidates, because a lot of money was withheld during this whole process. And I think, you know, they are going to be weakened in terms of being able to write checks to candidates who are running. So that could be an issue going forward.
Here's a general question. Are we too blue, just in the sense that we don't have really concrete discussions about larger issues because we are so blue? Any thoughts on that, David?
I mean, I think that sort of splits it into this national binary that we see of red versus blue. But, you know, you look at elected officials around here, I think you can find pretty legitimate policy differences. And I think there is sort of legitimately quite a bit of debate. So, you know, I don't if there are problems in King County, I'm not sure it's necessarily the result of a lack of debate. We mentioned the head tax before. That's
right.
Going to be a very fierce fight. And, you know, all those people would describe themselves as more blue than red, certainly.
Well, speaking of blue v. red, Stuart Elway's new poll says a blue wave is coming. Democrats are surging in the run-up to the fall elections. The open 8th district seat of Dave Reichert's is one place where that might come into play. There are also some questions about how incumbent Republican Kathy McMorris-Rogers in the 5th district will fare in November. The Elway poll showed McMorris-Rogers with a 6% lead. Democratic challenger Lisa Brown, chancellor at Washington State University, former state Senate majority leader, called this nothing but good news. This week on The Record, Marcy Silman talked to Doug Dvornik. He's a reporter at Spokane Public Radio who worked with Stuart Elway on this poll. She asked Doug, is the 5th district about to be flipped?
Yes, maybe. There are a lot of variables. For example, we found out in this study that about a half of the people who were polled didn't approve of Donald Trump's his job performance, and her own job performance was roughly equal with the people who thought she does a good job with those who think she doesn't do a good job. So obviously she's got some hurdles here. But I guess I would submit that Lisa Brown is well enough known that somewhere down the line we're going to hear that she spends like a Seattle liberal and that her job performance rating as a legislator wasn't great either. So it's going to be interesting to hear what the rhetoric's going to be over the next 7 months.
David Crumman, do polls mean anything at this point?
Well, this one in particular, I think, if I read it right, I think they said that the margin of error on this one was plus or minus 11 points or something like that. I think that's, at least in the swing districts, I think they said they only had 85 respondents. So the sample size in this is fairly small. So I can't speak to whether or not this is a good poll or not. They seemed pretty upfront about that it might not necessarily reflect what will end up happening. But it is sort of astounding that we're even talking about Kathy McMorris-Rogers as being a potential swing district. I think everybody was focusing on the 8th district with Dave Reichert for the people on the left who felt burned by Donald Trump's election were sort of focusing on the 8th. It doesn't seem like it's been until recent months that district has also been a topic of conversation.
Well, it may be a very opportune moment for Lisa Brown to be in this race.
Right. And I mean, I think I saw that some sort of political operative over there, tweeting out that, well, we haven't even started talking about Lisa Brown's record yet. So once we get into that, basically, this isn't going to be a race. So I don't know, maybe she's benefiting from not having quite the same name recognition or not having the sort of background vetting that she will get eventually. I'm not sure.
Do you think people care about Lisa Brown's record in the state Senate, though? I mean, I honestly, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
They might not. I think the margin of error you're talking about, I think on this Kathy McMorris-Rogers poll, it was actually like 6%. I think the 11% was for a different part of
maybe,
the poll.
Okay.
But
Stuart Elway, if you can elucidate, It's at KUOW.
Right.
But I mean, that is, you know, within the margin of error. I mean, he called it statistically insignificant, that 1% difference outside the margin of error. So I think that's kind of astonishing for that particular district. And I think it does speak a lot to people's perception of Kathy McMorris-Rogers as this big Trump supporter. I mean, she wasn't initially, but ever since, I think since he became the nominee, maybe since he became elected, she has been all in for him for the most part. And I don't know if that's something she's going to backtrack on to secure her reelection or not, but I think that's going to be a significant issue.
One issue that's on the mind of Democrats, many people, is with a democratically controlled House and Senate, if that were to happen, is impeachment of President Trump. But I've also read that Republicans would love Democrats to make this an issue because they think it would totally energize the Republican Party and energize Trump supporters. Any thoughts on that as a tactic that Democrats could really misfire on or be successful with?
Well, I think I saw somewhere that if you actually drill into politics, a lot more of it is kind of about tribalism than legitimate differences of opinion. I mean, obviously there are that, but when it comes down to sort of blue versus red, there is sort of a lot of tribalism. And I think sort of crying impeachment that, you know, if the Democrats come in and they're going to impeach Donald Trump, that sort of, you know, it's an attack on our team. It would sort of amp up that level of tribalism. And I feel like it probably would help the Republicans.
Monica, what do you think?
Well, it seems like the current moment for Republicans, there's a pervasive feeling of defeatism, or with we've seen so many high profile resignations, and it's such a fractured party that it could be a really energizing thing. And I think Democrats have not always made the most calculated bets about how their actions are going to be perceived, especially when it comes to nominations.
What I thought was the most interesting part of this poll, though, was that Democratic enthusiasm might not mean anything if that enthusiasm doesn't actually show up in these swing districts. So we talk sort of broadly about generic polls and sort of who's the most enthusiastic. But, you know, from what I took away from this poll, it's totally possible that King County will just end up becoming more blue than it even was before. Yeah. But it might not have any bearing on who
right.
gets elected.
That was the question about, yes, it might, blue voters might come out, but it might be in places where it doesn't matter because they're already in the majority.
Right. And I feel like you could sort of generalize that nationally, too.
But Eric, I'm curious about your take on whether impeachment works for Democrats or works against Democrats. What do you think?
Well, I agree with Monica that they're not always the most calculated. I think it would work against Democrats if they went for impeachment before the elections. But I also I would hope that, as someone who is not a fan of President Trump myself, I would hope that they would be smart enough to do some polling on that, realize it's a bad idea in the short term, if it is a bad idea in the short term, and not do it. But I want to just quickly speak to the swing districts in the state legislature. The state legislature right now, I mean, we forget it is, we are in a, a one party state right now, but it's very, very narrow in both houses. And I thought it was interesting. And I don't know where, if this is going to go anywhere, if he's going to just completely be routed, but Rodney Thom is back running in the 48th.
And the so-called Democrat who flipped the state Senate to the Republican side by aligning himself with them and becoming head of the majority coalition.
Yeah. So Rodney Thom is effectively a Republican, but he says he's going to run as a Democrat against incumbent Patty Cooterer. And I think that just highlights the fact that some of these swing districts, even if Washington is incredibly blue overall, some of these swing districts are very purple still. I think they're trending more in a blue direction. But as we've seen in the I think it's the 41st with Monica Dhingra, a Democrat elected over there for the first time in a long time. And but I think we forget that the state legislature is still in the balance, and this is still a state that has a lot of Republicans. We just don't necessarily perceive it so much over here in King County, west of the mountains.
Didn't they say that only 8 districts sent a Republican and a Democrat to Olympia? So meaning that there are very few actual swing districts in Washington state, but those will decide who controls Olympia.
I would say that 8 of 49 swing districts is a significant number.
Yeah.
It's Week in Review, and when we return, do Seattleites play hopscotch? This is KUOW Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Our guests on Week in Review, David Croman, city reporter for Crosscut, Monica Nicholsberg, civic innovation editor for GeekWire, and Erica C. Barnett. The C is for crank. So, Monica, you've uncovered a really interesting story. There's a viral brand that chalked a hopscotch court in downtown Seattle and then secretly filmed it for 10 hours. So what have we learned about Seattleites and hopscotch?
Well, most of them will not stop to play hopscotch. It was downtown. I'm sure a lot of them were commuting or busy, but some of them did. And some, it was not something that you could predict based on looking at the person, like construction workers, old people, young people. A lot of them did. I think it was like 160. They did play hopscotch. And I just loved this video because I spent a lot of hours watching Mark Zuckerberg testify before Congress this week.
This was relief.
It was relief. It was, I mean, the whole week was dominated by this news cycle about how social media is causing all of these like really systemic issues and poisoning our democracy. And then it was just this like viral piece of candy on a Thursday, and it made me really happy.
Monica, tell the truth. If you'd gotten to that, would you have hopscotched?
Totally would have hopscotched.
How about you, Erica Barnett? Would you have hopscotched?
Absolutely not.
I thought you might be a little too dignified.
I am the most senior member of this panel, and I consider that beneath my dignity. No, I'd be worried somebody was taping me.
So you got your cowboy boots on today, Matt.
I do. Yeah, I'm breaking in my cowboy boots, heading to Texas in a couple days for a well-deserved vacation back home. And well, I think it's well-deserved anyway. I'm my own boss, so nobody can tell me no. One thing that I'm kind of thinking about doing, because real estate is so expensive in Seattle, I think the average house is now $820,000, something like that. So I'm looking casually at real estate down there in the Hill Country of Texas, thinking about getting a little home away from home down there. We'll see how that goes. In any case, it's going to be a beautiful time of year to be there. The blue bonnets are out.
And we hasten to reassure you, it'll be a home away from home. Seattle will remain home. And
absolutely.
You'll still be able to read The Sea is for Crank. And David Krohman, how about you? What you got up for the weekend?
Trying to stay dry, hoping to get outside, but not get too wet. I'm just, this rain is getting me down.
May I recommend my new waterproof pants that I just got? Excellent.
And I grew up here. People, I feel like locals like to make fun of out-of-towners because they can't handle the rain, but I'm a local and I can't handle the rain.
David Krohman, Monica Nicholsberg, Erica C. Burnett, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Also with us, tweeting Bree Ripley, Bill Radke's back on Monday. I'm Ross Reynolds. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. Amina Alsadi is our producer.